Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Guardians of the Holy Grail, the program dedicated to diving deep to uncover and expose the truth behind the ancient Holy Grail mysteries, the Knights Templar, and the secret societies. My name is Mark Amato Pinkham, and I'll be your host for the show. I created the Guardians of the Holy Grail radio show in order to clear up what I see as many misconceptions regarding the Holy Grail mysteries, the Knights Templars, and the secret societies that are currently floating around the internet and within certain academic and lay communities. I'm hoping to set the record straight with some hard facts from authors and researchers, as well as with testimonies from those who are currently members of the Knights Templars, of Freemasonry, or other secret societies. I myself am a Knight Templar of the International Order of Gnostic Templars, which was founded to revive the mystical rites and wisdom of the original Knights Templar that over the centuries have either been lost or ignored. Our Gnostic Knight Templar organization is both a mystical order, wherein we practice both alchemy and gnosis, as well as a research organization dedicated to finding the truth behind the mysteries of the Knights Templar, the Holy Grail, and the secret societies. Now, you can learn more about our organization, the International Order of Gnostic Templars, by visiting our website, which is www.gnostictemplars.org. Now, this show is for everyone, and we want to make sure we answer your questions. So if you have one, feel free to give us a call at our toll-free number, which is 888-815-9756. Today we have one of my favorite people to interview. My guest today is Lionel Fanthorpe, a researcher with over 50 years of experience in the metaphysical and esoteric field. He's also the author of many, many books regarding the Freemasons, the Knights Templar, and secret societies, and basically you name it, he's written about it. Many of you will know him as the Anglican priest who was interviewed in the documentary film Bloodline, and he was interviewed because of his extensive knowledge of Rennes-le-Château area and the mysteries surrounding the Bloodline. Lionel was actually one of the original researchers of the Bloodline to go to Rennes-le-Château in the 1970s. So he has quite an amazing background when it comes to that area. Lionel currently has at least 17 books in print, which cover a range of esoteric topics. The mysteries and secrets of the Templars, the Yoke Island mystery, mysteries and secrets of Masons, and one of his more current books is called Secrets of the World's Undiscovered Treasures. You can learn more about Lionel and order his books by the website, which is www.lionel-fanthorpe.com. So greetings, Lionel. Welcome to the show.
As always, it's a great pleasure to be in your company, even if it's only electronically. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, as you know, I admire your intrepid search for the world's mysteries, because it's very much like my own. And so that's one reason we have a lot to talk about, especially in regards to the Knights Templar, the Holy Bloodline, and the secret societies that you've done so much research on. Recently when I talked to you over the phone, you mentioned a discovery in Bosnia that was a pyramid, apparently, that was discovered, and I guess you've got some information you can tell us about it.
Yes, I certainly would, and love to share that information with you and our listeners, Mark. Now, the thing that intrigues me first about the mystery of the Bosnian pyramid is that there is tremendous controversy as to whether they are genuine, whether they are man-made, whether they are artifacts, and if so, who made them, where did they come from? And on one side of that argument, we have the traditional academic archaeologist, what we might call the establishment archaeologists, who are, very, very well educated and first-class men in their field. And on the other side, we have a researcher, a very interesting and unusual man named Semir Osmanagic. And he is an American, born in Bosnia, now down in Houston, as far as I know. He believed that the hill, the Visočica hill, on which the old town of Visoki was once sited, it's 213 meters to the top, and it is pyramid-shaped. And his theory, the Osmanagic theory, is that this could be as much as 12,000 years old, and that a highly cultured technological group were responsible for constructing it. He has also claimed that there are mysterious tunnels within it, and another of his claims is that he has found some very strange inscriptions. And what I find so interesting about the research into this Bosnian pyramid theory is that you have, as it were, almost a lone researcher going after something new and different, which apparently contradicts the accepted archaeological history. And on the other, you have all the formidable array of top archaeologists with their university backgrounds all saying that he is wrong and that it's a perfectly natural formation, and if there are any archaeological remains there at all, they are simply those of the hunter-gatherers from the early Stone Age. Now, I like to give our wild child, Osmanagic, the benefit of the doubt in thinking that he is on the brink of discovering something. And I find it so sad that conventional archaeology turns against the joker, the wild card explorer, and doesn't really give him the chance to make his points objectively. Now, I was very complimented when you said that you and I have a lot in common, because you are a man whom I greatly admire. And I love your show and the things that you do, that you're setting out to do, and your whole attitude to it. I think it's absolutely right. And I think that open-minded, objective researchers like us would be just a little more inclined to listen to Osmanagic and his theories about this pyramid. When you see pictures of it, it certainly looks like a pyramid. And it doesn't look as if it was something that was carved out by nature. Now, whether it is or not would require a great deal of very careful scientific and academic exploration. And by turning on him and not offering to go and look, which a number of traditional archaeologists have done, to be fair to them as well, I feel that we are more likely to get to the truth at the back of any new mystery if we pay just a little more attention to those, shall we say, rather erratic researchers like Osmanagic, and instead of crushing him at the outset, say, okay, we don't agree with you, but at least let us go and examine that pyramid with you. He maintains that there are three there, the big one, which he calls the Pyramid of the Sun, then another which he calls Pyramid of the Moon, and yet another which he calls the Pyramid of the Bosnian Dragon. And if he's right, and he claims that his excavations have produced evidence of building blocks as well as tunnels, and certainly earlier geological work has indicated that that hill was shaped by human activity. So there we have the two sides of the balance, the two pans of the scale, and I think it's intriguing because it ties in, if he is telling the truth and if he's right, ties in with one of my, no more than a hypothesis, that many of the ancient legends concerning Atlantis and Lemuria and Mu and the other tales of lost civilizations and lost continents could take us back to a highly intelligent culture thousands of years existing with a technology and a wisdom far beyond that of our hunter-gatherer ancestors. Now, if they were so, were they the survivors of Atlantis, some of whom went to Egypt, some of whom went to Bosnia, some of whom went to South America and Mesoamerica? Because there is a strange similarity between the artifacts from remote prehistory which have been turned up. And what if the great central interest of yours and mine into secret societies and, shall we say, wise leaders and guides and guardians of the rest of humanity, what if these wise leaders who have surfaced as Illuminati, as Templars, perhaps as the Priory of Zion, perhaps as one of the other mysterious ancient societies, what if they are really the remnants of the culture and the knowledge and the technology, which would have seemed magical to so many of our ancestors, that came from the lost land of Atlantis? Only a hypothesis. But whenever something like this Bosnian pyramid turns up, it does just light one more candle in the darkness of where these ancient wise leaders came from.
Well, I just have one question that comes to mind, Lionel. What evidence does this man have for these pyramids being as old as, well, 12,000 years?
Well, what he has found, or what he believes he has found, have been building blocks, have been tunnels, and going back through it, he has felt that the things that he has seen there and found there, looked at there, he has looked at the stone formations, the geological formations, and for him, they appear to be clearly artificial, whereas for some of the more traditional academic geologists, they are just natural formations. And where we have to look when we're attempting to answer that all-important question is who is likely to be correct about whether that formation is artificial, man-made, or whether it's natural. And there I think that with the academic weight on the side of the traditional archaeologists, perhaps Osmanagic is wrong, and that he has just been, as it were, deceived by it, rather like looking at natural features and seeing a face there, or, you know, the famous view of the face on Mars that caused a lot of consternation when it first turned up, and the way that some people can look up into the clouds and see faces and castles and imaginary lands or great ships sailing across the sky. I think a lot depends upon the powers, the creative, imaginative powers of men like him. And perhaps we have to have both sides, that we need the hard, firm, rigorous tradition of the scientists to balance the man with the imagination, the creative man, the fellow who's prepared to say, hey, this is a pyramid and it's thousands of years old and I think it was put up by a race with a... If we ask ourselves deep down, which would I rather was the truth, then I think the romantic element in me, and there's something I have to guard against in all my research, is to say, wouldn't it be marvelous if there had been an Atlantean civilization, and if that civilization had spread to Egypt and Bosnia and across to South America? seems somehow much more exciting and interesting, because you're then asking questions about what happened to them, where did they go, and just how high did their technology reach, and is this why we have a strange mythology about flight, about winged horses, about cloaks of invisibility? Do you think that maybe some of the old magical legends are a misinterpretation of half-remembered technologies which would have seemed like magic to the storytellers who put the tales together? And that's where the balance falls.
Well, I don't doubt that there's probably something very amazing in Bosnia. I was in Bulgaria myself in July, and I went to places that I hadn't been there before, and they've done some recent excavation, apparently, and they found these amazing megalithic sort of vaults and temples that they date back to between the 3rd and the 4th millennium. I mean, that's like, that's more than 5,000 years old. And this is Bulgaria. Well, apparently Bulgaria was where the Orphic civilization, you know, the Dionysian ecstasies and the Dionysian rites took place, and apparently they occurred many thousands of years ago. But what the things that I saw there proved that there had to have been a very, very advanced civilization. I saw vaults and temples that had a similar megalithic sort of architecture that I've seen in Egypt and in Peru. And in one place, there was actually, and my guide at the time said that this they believe this is a initiation chamber. It was actually, it started out as a gigantic block, maybe 20 feet by 15 feet, a gigantic block of granite. And the whole thing was carved out. And right now, if you go inside, it's nice, smooth walls, and there's a bench, a granite bench. And they even they opened up the top, and then they put a cover over this whole box. So it looks as though it was used for initiation chamber, something perhaps like the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, where conceivably the Egyptian initiates lay down within the sarcophagus for 3 days, 3 nights, whatever. What the archaeologists or some people are saying is that civilization in Bulgaria coexisted with Egypt and with the Crete civilization, and maybe there was some exchange going on between those three civilizations. So maybe it was Egyptians that helped build these structures. What's amazing, Lionel, is that there's at least, I went to a place where there's at least 10 mounds that are covered with grass that haven't even been started excavating, that are supposed to be full of the same sort of thing, with these vaults and incredible treasures and what have you. So if that's the case, I mean, why would it surprise anybody that something amazing could be found in Bosnia, you know?
Mm. No, I go along with you 100% there, because when we look at the evidence that you've seen with your own eyes there, we're up against not only the complexity of the artifact, we've then got to look into whatever kind of equipment was used to create it, and it is so wonderfully done that it would take a number of our modern contractors with a great deal of modern power machinery, even with laser cutters, to get edges like the ones that they got on such a very, very hard medium as the granite. And it's not only that complexity which you've outlined so clearly for us, but it is the extent. We keep on finding, you're saying there were 10 or 12 that hadn't been touched yet, and if we look further afield, there would be more and more. So we're looking at an ancient culture which not only seems to have had a very, very high level of technology, but had also got a great many citizens within it, had a great many personnel that they had extended in so many directions. And I very much like your idea of this sharing of the wisdom, because this is what you and I believe as the teaching function of what, for want of a better word, we might call the wise men, the great leaders, the people who encapsulated their secret wisdom in the great societies like the Knights Templar. And if we think of how far they reached in every direction, how many parts of the world they got to, it is quite staggering. And it raises the question yet again, if they came originally from Atlantis or Lemuria, if that was the center of this ancient culture with all its advanced technology, then where the dickens did the Atlanteans and the Lemurians come from? If let's just assume, for the sake of forwarding our discussion, that they were real, they did exist, they spread their knowledge, and they spread what might be termed their thinking, their philosophy, their religion. And when we talked about initiation rites, well, those are so widespread, they are to be found in almost every secret society, that you enter, you go through a period of training, and you are then initiated as if you had died and been brought back to life as a new man with greater knowledge and with a different outlook on life. And what is it that our ancient friends were teaching? And we get it in the New Testament as well. So for me, as a priest and a theologian, Jesus makes it enormously. It says, you must be born again. Well, is he referring to some very deep and important secret that was known to the initiates by the being born again? As it's normally understood by the Christian Church, it means that you get rid of the selfishness and the evil and the bad behavior that seems to come, sadly, so naturally to so many human beings, and you start again as a new person who loves his fellow men, who wants to teach them, to help them, to do everything he can to bring them happiness instead of the discord and the misery which selfishness inevitably produces. Because if everybody is fighting madly and competitively against everybody else, it doesn't produce anything like the happiness that can come from a society of brothers and sisters who genuinely seek each other's welfare.
Well, I think that one thing that comes to mind, Lionel, is that invariably the archaeologists, the Western academic archaeologists, are wrong. And they've gone all over the world and they have dated these ancient monuments and these megalithic temples and pyramids and so forth to fairly recent times, you know, within the last 5,000 years. But myself, having traveled to these places, I've actually talked to the natives, the elders of these countries, and they have a whole different story.
Indeed.
For example, in Peru, the elders say that some of the temples there are 50,000 years old. But if you talk to a trained archaeologist, well, they were built by the Incas 1500 AD. Or if you go to Egypt and you look at the Sphinx, well, the archaeologists starting to come around about the Sphinx, you know, because the wear is water wear, and the last time that there was that much rain in Egypt was, what, 8,000, 9,000 years ago. Yes. But you also have the Osirian there, a sunken temple that appears to be at least 12,000 years old. And the elders are also saying that the pyramid and the Sphinx are like 30 to 40,000 years old. And so who are you going to believe? Are you going to believe an unbroken lineage of elders that this knowledge has been passed down through? Where are you going to believe an archaeologist that shows up and he does some carbon dating and that's how he makes his determination about the age of these monuments? So I'd rather go with the elders myself. You know,
well, my instinct is to go along with you on that one, Mark, and to say that, just as you do, I feel that these oral traditions, that these unbroken lines of, again, we come back to the whole idea of what you and I are so centrally interested in, which is where the secret societies obtained their original truth, and how that truth was wrapped, perhaps, in story form, in symbolic form. If we take someone like Aesop and the wonderful fables that he told, each of which was so rich with symbolic meaning, and we then apply that, as it were, analogy technique that he used, and which he had learnt from somewhere. He certainly didn't invent it. It was a very fine part of human thinking and human mental development, that what we have is a way of preserving these ancient truths by passing them down from generation to generation, that they have to be learned, they have to be memorized, before you can become a senior member of one of these ancient, let's call them, truth-transmitting societies. You need to understand that the full nature of the language in which it is encapsulated. And I go along with you in saying we should pay far more attention to the traditions of the elders, which you've heard and studied at first hand, and to say to ourselves, let's analyze this in the way that a good theologian or Bible scholar analyzes the background of the prophet who wrote the book, analyzes the historical situation, the culture of the time, looks at the kind of language and the symbolism that those elders would have used, and then apply that same analytical technique and exegesis to the sacred words that have come down through the generations. And, I mean, these people can count. They are not innumerate by any means. And if they say 50,000 years or 30,000 years, they are just as capable of understanding what a year means or a millennium means than the men who measure it on the carbon dating machine.
Well, it's all true. It's all true. And one thing I wanted to quickly mention, something you said a few minutes ago about where did these civilizations come from? Where did Atlantis, Lemuria come from? And the one thing I found when I've done research of the various civilizations and cultures around the planet, invariably you find time and time again that in their creation myths, they talk about two twin boys. Who came here during the creation cycle, and they were the culture bearers, and they brought medicine, they brought healing, medicine, agriculture, writing, language, you name it. They brought all the fundamental rudiments of civilization. So it appears as if you study these ancient legends that that these masters or the original teachers came from someplace else.
Absolutely.
These twin boys came from someplace else and then they kind of landed here. But so it appears as though when they talk about the twin boys, that they're talking about, to my mind, a brotherhood, because they talk about, for example, the Kumaras, the two Kumaras, but there was also, they also talk about the Kumara brotherhood or the Kabiri brotherhood. And so these were actually many missionaries from different stars or planets that came, that brought these fundamentals of civilization. This is what I myself have found, and this is what seems to make most sense, is that it came from someplace else, basically.
Oh, it does make tremendous sense, Mark. And I think, again, if I can just use as a priest, if I can just use a little Christian analogy there, where Jesus and the early disciples talk about the church as the bride of Christ, as the partner of Christ. And the church, as we think of it, is a group of brothers and sisters living and working together according to certain moral and ethical teachings and with a certain spiritual ethos of kindness and goodness and generosity. Now, if Christ, in the teaching of and the early missionaries, are the one church, so they see a great mass of men and women who are cooperating and working together as if it was a single individual. So this mass of several thousand people becomes, in the early words of the Christian writers, the bride of Christ, the church to be. And so everybody is put together, all the thousands of people become one. Now, adding that to your excellent idea about a brotherhood not being just two brothers or the famous twins, but being a whole collection and yet identifiable as a single unit. So that I think your concept of having a group apparently as one person, we are one. Let's think about the famous story of the three musketeers, all for one and one for all. And when you've got that kind of loyalty, which, after all, in the moral and ethical teaching of any of the great organizations, whether it be the church or whether it be one of the higher groups within the secret societies, they are teaching unity and loyalty. You admit a member of the society and you trust him or her to become part of you. Paul talks about the body of Christ, and he says one man will be the equivalent of an eye, another will be the equivalent of an ear, another will be the feet which will carry him, another will be the hands which can do things. And we say, yes, all of us have a slightly different mission to perform, yet we are all one and we're all part of the same, we might call it a sort of supra individual. And, you know, there have been so many interesting scientific analyses made of the mind of a swarm of bees, or the mind of an entire colony of ants or termites. And one or two very avant-garde biologists have suggested that there might even be an invisible intelligence binding all these separate units together. Now, what if we take that concept to one of our secret societies or to one of our social groups of good men and women who are trying to make the world a better place for the sake of everyone, and say, yes, is there a kind of supra-personality, a kind of supra-intelligence binding 100 of us together? And who's to know whether explorers and researchers like you and me and Mr. Osman Agic, who has looked into the Bosnian pyramids, who's to say that we aren't in some way, in some form almost of mystical communication one with another, that we are each fulfilling a different aspect of one big purpose, which is to look for truth and to help others.
Well, one thing that you're excellent at, Lionel, is going in search of things. and this is why next question I want to ask you is, last time you were on the show, you shared that you believe that there was some Knights Templar treasure hidden in Argenavie, I think.
Argenavie in France, yes.
That was in the Loire Valley. And I'm interested in that, as well as if you know of any other locations in Europe where you feel quite sure that there is Templar treasure hidden.
Well, one of my favorite thoughts is that if we take the Church of Saint-Sulpice in Paris, which was so so closely involved with the mystery of Béranger Saunier, the priest of Rennes, which you very kindly mentioned and at the beginning of the show, when that I said I was there in 1975, 34 years ago. And it's nice to be a pioneer. But one of the very interesting informants whom I met in the village, because when I was there, there were still people whose grandparents had actually known Béranger Saunier. And they were able to tell me back in the 70s, because he lived until 1917. And so people who were alive in the 1970s would have had grandparents who actually knew the mysterious priest Béranger. Now, among the, again, we're back to these oral traditions and the great power of the secrets that come down by word of mouth within a trusted family, among trusted family members. And they were very much of the opinion that it was not until he took some mysterious manuscripts that had been brought to him to the expert paleographies at Saint-Sulpice in Paris that Saunier found the key to finding the treasure. Now, one of my theories, one of my hypotheses about the whole mystery of Rennes-le-Château, which is still far from being solved, is that there's a very strong Templar involvement, and that there may also be very strong Templar involvement at Saint-Sulpice. Now, whether it's concealed below the church itself, whether it is concealed within a Templar tomb, in the walls, or below the building itself, would be difficult to say without a lot more evidence from some of the ancient codes. But that would be one of the places that I would want to spend. Let's suppose I had won the lottery or got myself a very nice film contract and completed it so that I had enough to live on for 6 months without having to do any more work. And other than just exploring for the sake of exploring, then I would very much like to spend time talking to the clergy of Saint-Sulpice, looking through the sacred books that they have there and the sacred documents that they have there, searching for further clues, because I would link Saint-Sulpice with the wisdom and the secrets of the Templars of the time.
Well, what has led you on to believe that there is something in Saint-Sulpice? I visited there myself. Is there some kind of clues in the on the walls or on the floor, or what have you found there so far?
Right. Well, this is one of the things which the Templars were so good at. When we say that, we use the old phrase, the secret is writ large. If we go to the other side of the world and look at those mysterious Nazca lines, which again have got very strange messages hidden in them, which can really only be seen from the air, if you and I wanted to hide a secret message which a member of our brotherhood could read, because it would be part of our tradition that you looked on the big scale, then what better than to do it with the number of carvings, the number of paintings, the details in the carvings and paintings? Now, what I think is a really strong possibility is that after Saunier came back from learning whatever he learnt from the wise men of Saint-Sulpice, he began to redecorate his church of St. Mary Magdalene down at Rennes-le-Château. And in, for example, the Stations of the Cross, which he put around the walls there, there are all sorts of curious clues. And if we compare that little church of Mary Magdalene in Rennes-le-Château with the vast edifice of Saint-Sulpice, we can almost suggest that in certain places, one is a miniature of the other. And it is as if Saunier had tried to say something which would act as a clue for those who had eyes to see it and minds to solve it. It's almost as if someone had wanted to make sure that his daughters and granddaughters would understand where the wealth was hidden, if they ever needed it, and that he had built for them a very nice garden house or toy house or windy house in the garden, which was a miniature of the place where the treasure was concealed. If we take just one example of a secret in the Church of Mary Magdalene in Rennes, which may have come from Saint-Sulpice, it is that Station of the Cross where the Roman soldiers are playing dice for the robe of Christ. And the three dice, normally in the Stations of the Cross pictures, are just three faceless dice. You can see that they're cubes, and that's all you can see. But in the picture on the wall of Rennes-le-Château in St. Mary's Church, Mary Magdalene's Church, the dice are linked so that you can, one is standing on top of another to form a right angle, and the faces, as you study the painting, show you a 3, a 4, and a 5. And of course, you and I, and many of our listeners will know, that if you construct a triangle, as Pythagoras did, with a side of 3, 4, and 5, you have a right angle. So you have the dice at a right angle, and you have those Pythagorean numbers, the 3, the 4, the 5. You have to take, in my opinion, that measurement, those numbers, at 90 degrees from somewhere. Now, it may be from the altar of Saint-Sulpice, it may be from the tower, it may be from a particular tomb, it may be from a particular statue, but I am certain that one of the vitally important clues, both in Rennes and in Paris, is the 3-4-5 triangle with its Pythagorean number magic.
So if you had unlimited funds, like we all wish we did, mm-hmm. Would that be the one place that you would go in search of, the mysteries would be Saint-Sulpice?
Well, certainly it would be a very good starting point, because when we did all our research, Patricia and I did all our research for the latest of our books, which is the one that came out this year on the secrets and mysteries of undiscovered treasure, we looked just briefly into the forms that treasure could take. And some treasures take the form of being the clues to the places where greater treasures are to be found. And if I could just illustrate that with a simple story. As a boy, I went to school in a little town called Swaffham, which was famous for having a man who had been a peddler there. His name was John Chapman. And in the Middle Ages, John had a very, very strange dream. That if he, and of course dreams meant a great deal then, that if he went to London and stood on Tower Bridge, he would hear news that would make him very rich. And so he, obedient to the dream, and I think there's a lesson for many of us, we should perhaps pay attention when messages reach us in strange ways. John set off for London Bridge, and he arrived, saw nothing, heard nothing, and very disappointed, was about to turn and head back for Swaffham, 100 miles away, when a man stepped out of one of the houses and said, "I've been watching you. I suspect you are a thief, that you're looking to see when a house is empty." And John said, no, I'm here because," he said, "this will sound strange, I had a very weird dream, and I dreamt that if I came to London Bridge, I would hear something that would bring me vast wealth." And the man laughed, the man who's talking to laughed and said, "My dear boy, if I believed in strange dreams, you know what I'd do? I'd walk off to a little town called Swaffham in Norfolk, and I would dig under an apple tree in the garden of a local peddler. Isn't that stupid? He said, I'm far too sensible for that. Well, of course, John set off for home as fast as he could go, arrived in the depth of the night, asked his wife to light the lantern and come with him into the garden. They dug under their apple tree and found a crock of gold, an old Roman pot with some Latin writing round the side that they couldn't read, but enough gold to keep them going for several months. Well, being wise and cautious, they took all the gold out and hid it under the floor of their cottage and put the pot in the window in the hope that somebody would be able to interpret the Latin. Sure enough, some students from Cambridge walking through Swaffham on their vacation knocked on the door and said, where did you find that pot? And John, being a cautious man, said, well, I'm a peddler and I travel, and I found it on my travels many miles from here. Oh, what a shame, said the boys, because it says on the side in Latin, under me there lies a greater. And, of course, as soon as it was dark, down the garden go John and Mrs. Chapman with the lantern and the spade, and another 3 feet down they found a huge crock of gold, 5-6 times the size of the first one, and enough for them to help the poor, to endow Swaffham Church, where his name is still revered and honoured after all these centuries, and, of course, to live on comfortably for the rest of their lives. But it's the idea of that clue. Under me lies a greater. And it's as if the two sizes of the church, just as we were thinking, you see the analogy there with the little church of St. Mary Magdalene in Rennes-le-Château and the great church of Saint-Sulpice. And I think you have to look on the big scale. You have to see what that 90-degree triangle could mean in Saint-Sulpice. But, of course, that is by no means the only place. Another place that fascinates and intrigues me in France is the little town of Salon down in the southwest in Provence. And I did a program there because it's the last resting place of Nostradamus. And after a very sad and troubled life, because we remember that his first family, whom he adored, all died of the plague, even though as a doctor he had done his best to cure the plague in others. And after very unhappy years, he meets a beautiful young widow. They fall in love in Salon. And she's very wealthy, and it meant that he could give up work and write his amazing prophetic quatrains. And in the Museum of Nostradamus, which is the house in which he eventually died, and in the Church of Saint-Laurence in Salon, where he is buried in the wall, I think that some of Nostradamus's wisdom came from the same source that the Templar wisdom came from, and that he was, in a spiritual, mystical sense, very much a Templar sympathizer as far as the ethical and moral and spiritual and mystical side of Templarism is concerned. And I think that if you could measure from the tomb of Nostradamus, or from the home of Nostradamus, if you could just add the other pieces of information that were necessary, if we could apply, and this I don't think has been done to the depth it deserves, when his early quatrains are analyzed, I think they can possibly contain very deep and mysterious Templar codes. They're not just prophecies. There's more to them than that. And if we can get back to his original writing and see the links between Templarism and the things that he says in his very difficult to translate medieval French, I would hypothesize that there is a very interesting link between the wisdom of Nostradamus and the secret wisdom of the Templars.
Fascinating. I hadn't heard that theory before, Lionel. You know, there's as a Templar, and I have to ask this question because I am a Templar, and the one thing that we want to know the location of is Baphomet, the head of John the Baptist. Have you come across any kind of clues as to where that might be?
Well, this, of course, is absolutely fascinating. And it is one of the most important quests that I think any of us as researchers into the deep and the mysterious can ever have. And you and I are both familiar with the tragedy of 1244, when the Cathar stronghold of Muntzigur, not far from Rennes-le-Château, was overrun. There was terrible butchery. Now, the people who were defending Muntzigur, the Cathars who were defending Muntzigur, had at one time been very intimate with the Templars. There was a great deal of exchange of knowledge, and they were, of course, in the finest sense, Gnostic Christians, these Cathars, and they were told that if they all surrendered peacefully and made no trouble and took nothing out of their fortress of Muntzigur, then the Catholic army would not kill them, would let them go home as if nothing had happened. But if anything left the fortress, every last one of them, the women, the children, everyone would be burnt. And in spite of that terrible threat, four of the best Cathar mountaineers came down in the darkness, down the very, very steep rock on which Muntzigur stands, carrying with them what I believe may have been Templar treasure, not in the sense of money, but Templar treasure in the sense of some great religious object. It is possible that the Cathars of Muntzigur felt that safeguarding the head of John the Baptist, perhaps entrusted to them by the Templars, because Muntzigur was such a safe place, Mount Secure, literally, when we translate it, it would have been a place where Templars, sympathetic to the Cathars, had entrusted it. Let's just think of it in today's situation. Imagine that one of us is the manager of a bank in which there is a beautiful, wonderful, secure vault, and that the other one, we trust each other completely, the other one has something which is beyond price. So the colleague who has the great treasure says to the colleague who has the secure vault, please, will you look after this? It is worth more than anything. The head of John the Baptist is placed in the safe and trustworthy keeping of the Cathars, who prove just how trustworthy they are because they are willing to be slaughtered to a man rather than allow it to fall into the hands of the Catholic soldiers. And those four men escaped over the side of Muntzigur, carrying with them that mysterious head. Where did they put it? I would argue that it's within a 50-mile radius of Muntzigur Castle.
Well, that's a big tract of land, Lionel. Can you narrow it down for me a little bit better than that?
Well, if we were the mountaineers who had come down from Muntzigur, knowing that it was hopeless, then that we were going to lose the battle, where would we have hidden it? Muntzigur is surrounded by limestone caves. The best thing we could have done is to keep the knowledge to ourselves, sworn to secrecy, and to hide it in one particular cave. And in a way, we've got a parallel there with the Dead Sea Scrolls, that these vitally important manuscripts were hidden in a cave known only to the members of the society who held the truth. I would begin my search around Montsegur in any natural cavern which appeared to have had boulders and stones piled across its mouth. There, I think, we could discover this treasure of treasures, and it would be a part of the secrets of the Templars and the Cathars. What if, having hidden it, those same mountaineers made contact with their Templar brethren and passed on that vital location to men who were absolutely trustworthy?
Well, I'm ready to head down there, Lionel. Whenever, well, you just give me the word, and we'll head on down there. You get the ropes and cramp on.
We can do that together. Well, in my army days, I was the battalion rock climbing instructor, so I'll certainly come with you. I haven't forgotten how to do it.
You're ageless, Lionel. You can handle it. Well, it's as always, the hour flies by a lot quicker than we'd like it to, and we've come to the end of our program now, and it's certainly a pleasure to have you on again, Lionel. And
thank you.
Thank you so much, and we hope to have you back again. And those of you that like to hear about Lionel, Lionel?
Anytime you need me, you just call me. I'd love to be with you.
Thank you very much. And those of you that like to know more about Lionel and his work, go to www.lionel/fanthrope.com. And if you want to know more about us, go to GnosticTemplars.org. And thank you all for joining us today. We'll be back the same time next week with another very interesting guest. So please join us and have a wonderful week. Bye for now.
Bye now.